Today on Rockin' the Suburbs, we're here with Craig Rosen.
We're back in the saddle again.
Perfect. Hello, everybody. This is Mike Wagner, and I am here with my good friend,
Craig Rosen.
And today, we are here to talk about Aerosmith.
Yes.
And Craig, you were saying something before we started recording that you wanted to get in. What were you saying?
Yeah, I'm so happy and glad you asked me to do this, Mike, because, you know, I listened to, what was it, a few hours of you and Nick Scalera talking about REM.
We only talk in hours. There's no such thing as a short conversation with Nick and myself. That does not exist.
Well, a few episodes at least about you guys talking about REM, and you have to understand that was kind of like torture for me because, you know, I had a few things to say. I have a few things to say about REM and also a few things to say about Aerosmith, which was one of my all-time favorite bands still. They were definitely my favorite band in a period between Paul McCartney and Wings and punk rock. I can say that flat out.
Okay, two things about those comments. First, a lot of people say it's torture listening to me and Nick, so fair enough. Second is that I don't think most people know you're a big Aerosmith fan. I mean, most people associate you with REM, of course, because of your writings and, you know, fandom of them. But Aerosmith is a big band for you, right?
Yes, yeah, definitely. As my wife, we are just finishing up lunch, and she said, yeah, I'm sure you're going to tell them that your son is named Tyler Steven. And yes, that is true. Our eldest child, who is now a man, a school teacher, his name is Tyler Steven Rosen, and the name was inspired by Steven Tyler, I have to say. We also had a friend, or have a friend, who named his firstborn Miles Davis Nomura Feinberg. So it was kind of like inspired by them as well. And my son Tyler is not an Aerosmith fan. He is into a lot of female singers. I think his favorite right now is Caroline Polachek. So there you go.
The reason that we are here today to talk about Aerosmith, and we're going to talk about their legacy, and I suspect most of the folks who listen to this podcast know that recently Steven Tyler was actually diagnosed with a throat problem, something with his larynx, I think I read, and he damaged his vocal cords, and Aerosmith will no longer be touring. There is no word on if they would record. They haven't been a big recording band for the last several years. I think the last album was 2012, something like that.
Yeah, it's been a while. I have it up there on the CD. I pulled out all my vinyl, but didn't pull out the CDs, but they're up there as well. I think I have the last one. Can't even remember what the last one was. I think it's the one with the sort of female robot on the cover.
Yeah, something like that.
Whatever that was called.
We'll get into it, but I kind of lost him after. I kind of lost him after a while. He did do a country album. Which, yeah. I did see, to be honest, to jump ahead, I did see something on, I don't know, like some documentary or something he did on that. And he sounded really good on when they played some of it live. But anyway.
That's the thing. That's the thing about Aerosmith in general and Steven Tyler. I mean, I don't know about you, Mike, but I think I'm a fan of vocalists and vocalists with unique sounding voices. And it's kind of like a cliche, you know, oh, they could sing the phone book and I would love it, you know. And
yes. No, it's true, though. It's true.
Yeah. It's true of like all my favorites, you know, Steven Tyler, Michael Stipe, Richard Butler of the Psychedelic Furs, you know, and then, of course, Bob Dylan. These people with unique voices. And, if you're a fan, you know, you'll like almost everything they do just because you love their voices.
I agree. I went and saw Nico Case recently, so I have the same feeling towards like someone like that. I know what you mean. Like, she could sing. I was just thinking, when I went and saw her, I thought the same thing. She could sing anything and I would listen to her because I personally love the sound of her voice, you know. So what we're going to do, just basically it's going to be sort of a free flowing discussion about our thoughts about Aerosmith. Oddly, people may not know this about me, but I'm also a big Aerosmith fan. I don't, we'll talk about it, but they kind of lost me at one point. But I think they were a truly, truly great band and really underrated. But so real quick, let's just go over their history for just to remind folks. The early days, they came out of Boston, had a couple of albums. And actually, one of those first two albums was we've had this discussion before, Craig. The second one, Get Your Wings, is your personal favorite Aerosmith album, is it not?
It's one of them. I would say, yeah, that's probably the favorite. I mean, I love Rocks as well. You know, I didn't know that album when it came out. I think I discovered Aerosmith when a lot of people did. I think I probably heard Dream On the radio, but...
I remember hearing Dream On as a kid on the radio as well.
Yeah, I think I got into them when A Walk This Way became a hit and was getting radio play. And then I bought Toys in the Attic, and, you know, I was all in, and, you know, eventually went backwards, got the first two records, and was all in for a long time.
Yeah, so they had, and then they had two huge albums, which we were just talking about, Toys in the Attic, big hits, Walk This Way, Sweet Emotion.
Yeah.
And then Rocks, which is my personal favorite, and a hugely overlooked album, I think. And when people start talking about, you know, great albums, that tends to get left out. There's not a big, big hit like Walk This Way or Sweet Emotion. I mean, Back in the Saddle was a hit-ish, but not, it wasn't like, it didn't sort of, Walk This Way sort of broke the zeitgeist world. I mean, everybody kind of knows Walk This Way. Some people may not know Back in the Saddle. Like, I mean, obviously everybody who listens to this podcast would, but it wasn't like a big, I don't remember being a big, huge album. Do you? Am I remembering that correctly?
It was pretty big. I mean, I wasn't as tuned into what a successful record was. I was just, you know, more about, I was listening to the album rock radio stations back then in LA. That was KMET, The Mighty Met, and also KLOS, two pretty famous radio stations. And yeah, the thing that's interesting about Aerosmith, I know this for a fact about Dream On, and I think it also happened with Walk This Way, but Dream On was released as a single twice.
Right, yes.
Yeah, the first time it didn't do much.
And then the second time it became...
Yeah, and they were almost dropped before that became a hit. Like, they were sort of like on the ledge, living on the edge. of being dropped.
We see what you did there.
Then, you know, Dream On became a hit, which allowed them to go in and record Get Your Wings. And I recently read, I don't have it on my screen, but in the last few weeks I read a pretty good piece by, I think it was by Mick Wall, and was for that website Louder or Classic Rock. I think they're affiliated. But it was called How Aerosmith Got Their Wings. And it was all about, like, the early days and how they started working with Jack Douglas, the producer who produced, you know, their best albums. And, you know, how he told Tyler, Steven Tyler, on the first album, he kind of had a fake sort of phony put-on voice.
Right.
And Get Your Wings, he told him, you know, just sing, you know, find your true voice and sing, you know, as you are. And that said... Jack Douglas pulled in a couple guitar ringers from the Alice Cooper's guys to play on Get Your Wings because he didn't think Joe Perry and Brad Whitford were up to snuff, and they begrudgingly went along with the plan because they wanted to be rock stars. So
they rectified that. Perry and Whitford rectified that situation over the years. Probably get into it as well, but I think Joe Perry's a great player. Also, Brad Whitford, they really feed off each other. They're really quite good.
And just the whole Tyler Perry combination, I mean, it's just that classic rock duo. I mean, most obviously, you know, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were sort of the you know, the prototype for what they became. And, you know, they were what the Glimmer Twins were, the Stones, and Tyler and Perry were called the Toxic Twins for their abuse of substances. I don't even think I need to say allegedly because they've copped to it over the years.
Then they, after Rocks, they released Draw the Line and Night in the Ruts and went through a bunch of problems, lots of drug problems. The toxicity of the Toxic Twins became too much. Draw the Line is not a bad album.
It's not.
It's got its moment.
It has some great songs.
The title track rules the universe. A truly underrated Aerosmith song in my view. And they do it live a lot.
Yeah.
And when they do it live, it just rocks. It's fantastic.
Smoking, yeah.
Then they had, I think a lot of people are familiar with the collaboration with Run DMC to bring him back in the 80s with Walk This Way.
Yes, that was genius. That was incredible. I love that.
And then they released two fairly big albums after that. But for this, what was a bit different than the early days, they brought in songwriters. They released Permanent Vacation and Pump. And those were both hits. I say Permanent Vacation, it's got some good bits, sounds a little dated now, I would say, but the hits are really great. I do think the hits are really good on there. There's a lot of, I would say, not great songs, but okay. And they brought in some outside writers like Desmond Child and Jim Vallance, but I would say Pump is awesome. I love Pump. I think it's way overlooked. I know it's after Permanent Vacation. Yeah, Love in an Elevator is kind of, the lyrics are whatever. But man, that album rocks. That album is solid from the word go. I mean, it just really, for me, it's one of my favorites.
That's the thing, Aerosmith, they often, most of their lyrics are kind of dopey. I mean, you know, that's why they appealed to me, because I was a dopey teenager at the time I, you know, discovered them. But the thing about Aerosmith, going back to the earlier days, you know, when I was, how old are you, Mike? I think I'm a little older than you. Are we the same age? I'm 61.
I was born in 65.
Okay, so I'm a few years older. You know, when I was in, like, more junior high and high school a little bit, too, everybody was into Led Zeppelin. Like, everyone in my high school. Led Zeppelin,
oh, really?
Led Zeppelin. Yeah. And it was, I just found it so annoying because, you know, at that time, I couldn't really relate to, I didn't really appreciate Led Zeppelin as much. And I guess I was kind of like a, you know, it wasn't like punk rock term, but I was kind of like a punk and a contrarian. You know, I didn't want to be like everybody else. And for me, Aerosmith was the alternative to Led Zeppelin. They weren't, you know, Steven Tyler wasn't singing about Misty Mountain Hops and BS like that. He was singing about the cheerleader who was a real young bleeder. And, you know, I don't know if that really sunk in, if I even knew what he was talking about at that point, but it sounded cool, you know, and they had so much energy. I mean, I appreciate Led Zeppelin a lot more now, you know. I sort of belatedly, you know, got into them a little more, but at the time, just Aerosmith, I mean, before punk rock, you know, they were sort of like punk rock to me. They were sort of like, I mean, they had hits and everything, but they had an attitude. They were outcasts. They were rebels. You know, they were, you know, basically talking smack in their songs.
After Pump, they released Get a Grip, which had tons of hits, the videos, and they became sort of megastars again. Get a Grip, is kind of where I kind of, they lost me. It was just, I didn't really care for the album. It just sounded all too forced. I didn't really care for it. Not to say that it's bad, but it's just not my thing. And then they have what, they had the big hit with Don't Want to Miss a Thing. And I can't remember what else they did after that. Just a bunch of, there was one song after that that was great in my view. Jaded is awesome. I love that song. Like, where that came from for them, like, it came out of complete left, you know, usually at that later in your career you don't get a song that cool, but it's just sort of the shining beacon in their later career. And I love that song. That's one of my favorite.
It's so good. Everybody slept on that one. It should have been a hit. It should have been huge.
The album is very blah. I tried listening to, I mean, it came out, I was like, okay, I'm gonna try listening to this. Because I heard Jaded and I loved it, but I just couldn't get into it. But, you know, there you go.
Yeah, that was on that I guess that last album, Just Push Play, in 2001. Wow.
That was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, but they did do that blues, they did the blues album, but that was a covers album, that Honkin' on Bobo.
Yeah.
And again, the stupid double entendre, but, you know, that's Aerosmith. That's what they're known for. That's Steven Tyler.
That kind of covers their history. I think the main thing, and you and I kind of changed some notes before the episode, and I think the main thing for me about the way I tend to judge bands is there's kind of this sort of high water mark that bands hit. And when Aerosmith is at their high water mark, they're in rarefied air, right? They're in a rarefied group. They didn't stay there long. They kind of screwed a lot of it up by their, you know, their toxicity, to be quite honest. You know, there seems to be a lot of, there's something about that band that just seems like always, any moment they're going to fracture. You know what I mean?
Self-destructive, even before the Replacements.
Yeah. and the Replacements do, and you kind of want to laugh at them.
Yeah.
And you kind of want to side with them. But the Aerosmith just seemed almost, I don't know.
Tragic?
As much as, yeah. Not, no, because...
Yeah.
Childish, actually. You know, it's like, you know, when they say the first breakup was literally over spilt milk at a show, right? I'm sure you've heard that story, right? And you're just like, guys, come on, geez, you know?
There's a funny, you're saying, that though, there's a funny thing that when... Whitford and Perry were out of the band at one point, and Whitford at one point ended up playing on an album by this guy Rex Smith, who was sort of like a teeny bopper actor guy, I believe. You know, he wasn't like a credible rock singer, and me and my friends joke that, you know, hey, you know, he was so messed up. And I don't know if Brad Whitford indulged in the substances like Tyler and Perry, but the joke was that he was so effed up. They just, hey, you want to play on the new Smith album? And he's like, oh, great, we're back together. And he went in and cut his tracks, not knowing it was Rex Smith.
Anyway.
There's a lot of bands that try to have that sort of swagger that they had. And... It is, I mean, you're there's very, very few bands that can pull that off. And like, even when you watch them in their later years, like, you know, I love going back and watching some of their live stuff on YouTube and stuff, you know, and around, I mean, there's some, especially for some reason around 2010, for whatever reason there is, there's some freaking great versions of songs around that time. And when they were on all cylinders, I mean, they are in my opinion, truly rarefied air. There's not many bands that played as hard and rocked and just, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. I didn't watch closely. Was there probably some extra backing tracks or some hidden background singer or whatever? Yeah, sure, whatever. But despite that, I thought they were freaking great.
Yeah, they basically kicked ass most of the time live. But they could be, you know, they could be, have an off night. And, you know, when there was a lot of drugs going around, sometimes they weren't as good as they could be. I've seen them at least four times through the years. The first time I saw them, I think it was 78 at the Long Beach Arena, and AC/DC opened for them.
Wow.
And then the next time I saw them was at a festival at the Coliseum called the California World Music Festival. And Aerosmith was the headliner on the day that I went. Other bands on the bill, like the opening act was the Boomtown Rats. Who else? Toto. Like bands like April Wine. But the second billed band was Van Halen. And
this is
when they were hotter than you can believe. You know, they were fast rising. I think it was right around the time, I don't know if Van Halen 2 was out yet, or maybe right around the time it was coming out. So they were on top of the world, and Van Halen kicked ass that night. And then Aerosmith came on, and people started leaving when Aerosmith was on. And there's young Craig in the crowd.
Were they bad?
They weren't bad, but they weren't, you know what, they weren't as exciting as Van Halen. I'll give them that. But I was like, what are you, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I might have actually said it to some people, what are you doing? You can't leave? It's Aerosmith. You know, you can't leave. You know, I was very frustrated and disappointed. But, you know, Van Halen did kick their butts that night.
But when you watch, like, some of those videos, like, from 78, because they used to play in Texas, there used to be the thing called the Texas Jam, and they would play there a lot of times. And you'll see, like, these, you know, them playing at the Texas Jam, and they are just, they're gone, man. You can just look at them, and they are gone. They are not there. And you're just like
on autopilot. But they could still do it most of the time, which is strange, you know.
I mean, that's kind of why I was amazed that and one of the things I actually wanted to talk about was I don't think a lot of people realize that getting to the top of the mountain once is unbelievable amount of work. An unbelievable amount of skill, an unbelievable amount of dedication and all that. Getting there twice, that's really difficult.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible how they revived their career and came back and were more successful than ever. I mean, I think you agree with me that, you know, the first stint with Columbia Records was with their prime. You know, that was the good stuff.
Yes.
But they had their bigger hits in the Geffen years, you know. But, you know, the fact that they were able to just reinvent themselves and come back, I mean, but they reinvented themselves with staying true to their past.
I think so.
Yeah, it wasn't like a complete sellout. I mean, they were doing, you know, if you're saying, oh, they're doing ballads now, Dream On was a friggin' ballad.
At the end of Toys in the Attic and at the end of Rocks, there's two ballads, massive ballads, and I love both of them. They're just freaking great. They are awesome ballads, and I don't care. Say what you will. I don't care. I love them.
You see me cry.
just feel it. I mean, his voice, he's, you know, it's real and he means it. You know, I mean, you can feel it. It's not just a pose. You know, he was going through this stuff and he was letting it out in his vocals and you could hear it. That's why the guy probably blew out his voice. He's just like so passionate.
If you watch him sing on those videos from the 2000s, I'm like, yeah, I get it. I mean, he sings. He puts a lot into his singing. And there was like a video from Pittsburgh, you know, because they started up a tour in 2023, I think it was. And the Black Crowes are going to open for him. And there's a video out there from Pittsburgh where they play something. And I've watched it, and I'm like, dang, he is really, really singing. And when he did that solo thing that I was telling you about earlier that I watched, he was really, really singing. I mean, he was like, you're right. I mean, he's really, really an underrated vocalist. I mean, I love the Stones. I worship the Stones, but Mick is Mick when he sings, and Steven Tyler is a more dramatic vocalist, I would say. Not as good as lyricist, but...
Yeah. And you can... I mean, you brought up the Stones, and there's, you know, that comparison sort of dog Aerosmith early on, you know, singer with the big lips, smoking guitar player, you know, it's...
What are you going to do?
That whole thing.
And when you call yourself the Toxic Twins after the Glimmer Twins, it's like, you're sort of invited. But I don't think it ever bothered them. I mean, I wouldn't mind being compared to Mick and Keith. I could live with that.
Obviously, they were an early influence, and you know, rock critics pointed to the Stones as being an inspiration for Aerosmith, and you know that was true. But, you know, I think they sort of transcended that eventually. And then Aerosmith ended up being a huge impact on a lot of the sort of, you know, metal bands or hard rock bands that were to come, you know, especially like Guns N' Roses. I know Slash has said that Rocks is one of his, might be his favorite all-time album. But yeah, Guns N' Roses, you know, I think the Black Crowes, you know, as you said, you know, definitely a Stones influence there too, but I think there's an Aerosmith influence as well. And even the Replacements, I think, like, you know, I don't know if they would own up to that, but like Shooting Dirty Pool and Lay It Down Clown on Tim, I think those are pretty much, like, I could hear Aerosmith doing those songs. They're almost Aerosmith songs to me.
And there was a band who covered them who you might be familiar with.
Who's that? What?
R.E.M.
Oh, yeah.
They did, of they course, did Toys in the
yeah.
Attic.
Yeah, duh.
You meant a little band from...
Yeah, that's so interesting because, you know, on paper, I was so excited when that came out and when I heard about it. And I have to admit, I like it, but I don't love the R.E.M. cover of...
No, I mean, that's just not who they are.
I mean, yeah.
It's just not who they are.
It doesn't... I mean, they can kind of do that stuff, but yeah, it sounds a little wooden to me.
I mean, it's fun, right? We shouldn't... It wasn't like they put it out on an album and thought it should be, you know, it was like, what was it on?
It turned up on Dead Letter Office.
Yeah, Dead Letter Office, yeah.
Yeah.
The thing, though, that I would say about the band you were talking about, except for the Black Crowes, is, and even the Replacements, is sort of that sort of swagger and that sort of feel that Aerosmith had to the music, where it wasn't just that straight rock drums. I mean, they were much better at sort of the boogie. That's a really, really, I mean, a lot of rock and roll bands try it. Few succeed. I mean, it's in my view, it's a pretty short list, but I'm a harsh critic. I mean, there's like the Stones, Aerosmith, the Black Crowes, they all can do that thing. And there's very, very few bands. There's probably a couple that I'm not thinking off the top of my head, but it's a short list. I mean, like, there is no swagger in Guns N' Roses. Like, there's just no, the guitars are just sort of really straight. I mean, this is not an, you know, I'm not a fan, but there's like, I'm a huge fan of the Replacements, but they still don't have that. They don't play that way. They don't play that sort of bluesy, swaggery rock and roll like Aerosmith does or the Stones do, in my view.
Yeah, you're right. You know? And I think one of the things is that, you know, Steven Tyler was very influenced by R&B and soul music. I mean, you look on that first album.
Oh, yeah. You know, absolutely.
there's a cover of Rufus, I think Rufus Thomas's Walking the Dog.
Walking the Dog, yeah.
Yeah. And later on the live bootleg album, they do James Brown's Mother Popcorn, you know, which is just, I just love that.
The other thing is that Steven Tyler started out as a drummer.
Oh, yeah.
And I would really recommend this if you haven't watched it. Inu and I talked about it. There's a documentary about the making of Pump, and it's on YouTube. It's about hour and a half, hour 45 minutes. It's really, really great. There's some bits that are Spinal Tap-ish when they're talking about making the album and they're talking, and it's a little iffy. But when they're in the studio and when they're working on songs and when they're talking about what it takes to get a song from a good song to a great song, and like, and there's this bit where Tom Hamilton talked about it. It goes like, when things aren't working, the thing you do is you go and you find what's not working, and it's usually vicious, right? And they had that ability to do that. Not, I don't think most bands have that ability to do it, to get to that, to make those songs just go to that next level, and they take off, like, and put you in that rarefied air.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's easy to get to a certain bit, but like to go to like where you're just like, you know, like some of the songs on Rocks are just like unbelievable to me.
Funky, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned about Tyler being a drummer, and you know, you got a feel for Joey Kramer, not only with his health issues and eventually getting sort of pushed aside, but Tyler was a real taskmaster because he was a drummer, and he's constantly breaking Joey Kramer's balls. You know, play it this way.
Oh, there's if you watch that documentary, there's a bit in there where he goes. And Joey, him and Joey are going at it. And he's like, Steven, what do you want me to do? And he's just like, what do you want? He goes, I want this. He's like, that's what I did. You know, and it's like this back and forth. And it's crazy. Hello there. So this is Future Mike. And we're going to end part one there for today. And we will be back tomorrow with a continuation of our discussion. More fun in store. So you got that to look forward to. And for now, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
yelled at me.